Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the White House, and thank you for coming to the White House Forum on Smart Finance for Disaster Resilience. And to those who are joining us on live stream, thank you for tuning in. My name is Janie Bavici, and I'm the Associate Director for Climate Preparedness at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. We have a jam-packed schedule today with a great lineup of speakers. So without further ado, I would like to introduce someone who has been absolutely instrumental in implementing the President's Climate Action Plan, including helping to reach an international agreement in December, which is certainly no small feat. So I'm very pleased to introduce Brian Deese, Senior Advisor to the President.
Hi there. Welcome to the White House. Good morning, and we're very happy to have all of you here, particularly on a week in August where this town tends to shut down. But with 6 months left in our administration, we're trying to take advantage of every minute that we have left, and we're very pleased that you all are here today to help us do that. I'm going to be very brief here at the front, just try to make a couple points to put this convening and all of this work in the context, at least in terms of how we think about it, in terms of our broader climate, energy, and conservation effort. And I just want to make a couple points at the top. The first, I hope this is obvious to all of you who are consumers of news and consumers of the policy and the information that we operate with in this space, but I think it bears repeating, which is that there is no issue, domestic or international, that is of greater personal importance to the President of the United States than combating climate change and preparing our economy, our communities, and communities around the world for the growing risk that climate change faces. You've seen that manifested in an all-of-government effort, which we often refer back to as our Climate Action Plan. But in practice, this is an all-of-government effort to try to address the climate mitigation issues as well as the resilience and adaptation challenges that we face. Consistent with that all-in focus from our administration, the good news is we are making some significant progress. I think it's probably the most notable and underreported fact out there that since the President took office, carbon emissions in the United States have fallen more than any other country in the world during the same period where GDP growth in the United States was greater and more robust than any other advanced economy in the world. So we are proving and have proved over the last several years that the old trade-off between fighting climate change and growing your economy and creating jobs no longer applies, and if you are smart about this, and if we are forward-looking about this, we can lead the world in both. And obviously, our efforts are bearing fruit in the international arena as well. In part because of that progress domestically, we were able to bring the world together to agree on the Paris Climate Agreement at the end of last year, and that effort is only one part of a global coming together around these climate issues, including this year working to build on that progress to address HFCs, aircraft emissions, and other important global threats. So that's the first point I just want to make sure that you all leave here with and frames the conversation that you all have today, which is that you have a president and administration that is all in on addressing this climate threat. The second point is that we have, in service of that effort, tried to elevate the importance of resilience and of thinking in a forward-looking way about how to get ahead of these coming challenges and how to make smart investments today that will reduce costs in the future. This is in part a function of the fact that we have, during this administration, lived through a period of increasing natural disasters, increasing risks to our homeland, to our military installations, associated with changes in the climate. You'll have an opportunity to interact with several administration officials who are on the front lines of our domestic national security responses to these crises. And we have sought to learn from these efforts as they are accelerating. We have lived and been here through a period where drought in the West has gone from a periodic and episodic thing to business as usual. Where the wildfire season in the West has gone from up and down to predictably on an upslope every year. In the first 6 months of this year alone, we have already recorded 8 weather and climate related $1 billion events. And we just last week or over the weekend saw a once in a thousand year rain event just up in Ellicott City, Maryland, which tragically took the lives of some of the residents there and upended an entire historic community. So even though we are trying to change the conversation on resilience in a more fundamental way, we're trying to engage Congress in that effort and trying to get additional legislative tools. The truth is that the type of change, fundamental change in thinking, and the magnitude of investment necessary is something that the public sector isn't going to be able to do alone or be able to do principally. And so it's clear that we need to be smart about leveraging investment, private investment in this space, and we also need to change this conversation from one where we address disasters and address risks after the fact to one where we plan smartly and we create new incentives and new financial structures to get ahead of these issues. So consistent with my first point about being all in, we're trying to think about how we can use the federal tools that we have more creatively to this end. And I hope over the course of the day, you get an opportunity to hear from and learn a little bit about the things that we're trying to do at the federal level. There are several that I've had an opportunity to be a part of in this administration in various capacities, whether it's trying to figure out how to get more financing to residential homeowners so that they can do a resilience retrofit of their home with no money down on the front end, or whether it's trying to improve the resilience of our federal assets, our federal buildings as well. We ran, as probably many of you know, the first national disaster resilience competition through HUD with some of the money from the Sandy Supplemental, awarded $1 billion to 13 states, counties, and cities to try to support and catalyze this kind of forward-looking resilience investments. And we're looking at the levers we have on the regulatory front as well, building codes and standards and other things that we can do at the federal level to try to set rules that will, again, unleash federal investment. I think you'll find, and I hope you'll find, that the administration officials that you interact with today are going to be very open to what more we can do at the federal level. But that leads me to my third point, which is probably the most important, which is the single most important thing that we could get out of today and that all of the team from the administration that you'll be interacting with today is we need to learn more from you. This is a space where principally it's not going to be the federal government or federal dollars alone that solve this problem. And I think that this is a space where in my understanding of the issues, states, localities, and private sector entities, non-governmental entities, are actually outpacing us in terms of trying new and experimenting with new models and new tools. And we really need to learn from everything that you all are doing. You've got an incredible group here from across the country, and you all are thinking about this in ways at the state and local level, which provide incredible opportunities for us to learn, share experiences, and then try to build those back into what we're doing at the federal level, and also how we can engage Congress, because some of this is we are going to need increased resources or changes of laws. So what I found in these convenings is that the most valuable thing to do is to try to encourage a very open conversation. And I mean that last point very seriously. We value incredibly your time and your being here because we need to learn from everything that you're doing so that we can improve our efforts at the federal level. So let me just end where I began, which is to thank you for being here. Thank you for your support for this effort. This is, you know, on behalf of the president, there is nothing more important, and we want to take advantage of all of the time that we have here left to try to get this right and build a more solid foundation. And with that, I will conclude and do what is my most important duty here today, which is to introduce our FEMA administrator, who I assume is somebody that if all of you don't know, you at least know of. But Craig Fugate is a national treasure. He is a steady and effective hand during the periods of greatest crisis for many of our communities. But he's also, and I think particularly important for this convening today, he is also one of the most creative and forward-looking policymakers in thinking about not how do we just address the next crisis or the next disaster, but how do we redesign the system so that in the next 20 or the next 50 disasters, we as a country have reduced our liability, whether that's financial or in terms of the human toll. So we are all very fortunate to have Craig where he is, and that includes to have Craig here today. So with that, Ambassador Fugate.
Those of you that know me know that Brian is much too kind. You know, we talk about climate and resiliency, and you talk to most people, it either goes over their head, they don't care, or they don't see how it applies to them. And there are still people who want to debate that change is even occurring. When Sandy made landfall, the president gave me a different challenge. He said, Craig, you know, the debate about climate change is over. There's still noise out there, but it's happening. And he didn't expect FEMA to be the person to solve climate change. He did want FEMA to be focused on how do we adapt. Because our current coping mechanisms are not sustainable. If you look at our built infrastructure and you look at the environmental risk, we built for the norm. We built based upon data and experiences that as long as we stay within those norms, yes, we'll have disasters, there'll be impacts, but it's within the capacity of the system to deal with it. And essentially, the way we've dealt with disasters is we transfer money. We take money from taxpayers who weren't affected, and we spend it for the people that were affected. And that model has worked pretty good under the Stafford Act. As long as we were dealing with what we expected. However, the history of our past disasters and our meteorological data has not been a good indicator of the growing risk and exposure that we as taxpayers have. Katrina, as many people would like to point out, one of our worst natural disasters, not a very effective federal response, fell into two categories. Those of us in the business that said it wasn't as bad as it could have been, to the others who are going, I never thought it could be this bad. This was a terrorist disguised as a hurricane, you know. And I'm like, not really. We had a conference on it that year. We had an exercise that was actually worse than that. Katrina was pretty much just something that would happen. The question was when. So when the president gave me this challenge of, what are we going to do differently? The first thing I realized was our overdependence of looking at past data to predict future decisions. If you've ever dealt with FEMA, one of the tools we've looked at of how to build back better has been our mitigation programs. Generally after disaster, we not only pay for uninsured losses, now this is a key word, uninsured losses in the public infrastructure, but we would also provide additional funds to make improvements to reduce the future cost of disasters. And if a structure was damaged when we rebuilt it, we would offer a cost share to build back better above code if we could demonstrate through a cost-benefit analysis that it was a good investment. But the cost-benefit analysis was always based upon the previous data. So particularly if you're looking at weather-related phenomenon, which flooding is our largest, most frequent disaster loss, tropical cyclones, wildfires are a symptom of drought, basically wind, water, and fire. Our data was inconclusive or missing or oftentimes did not really reflect the true risk. So you heard Brian talk about the 1,000-year event, like, wow. I'm like, I've been here 7.5 years. It's probably about the 11th or 12th 1,000-year event I've seen. 100-year events have gotten to the point where that's like every week or so. And it really reflects the fact that it isn't the fault of the scientists, it's that we have that short. Do you know when we started collecting weather data consistently in the United States over large areas and who did it? President Grant, Army Signal Corps. So basically from after the Civil War is really the only true data collection we've had across large areas of the United States. And if you look at climate, that's like a gnat's eyelash of data. And when you start looking at a changing environment to only look at your past data, it's like driving 100 miles an hour trying to steer by looking through the rearview mirror. As long as I don't run the shoulders out of my mirrors, I'm doing okay, but what if there's a curve? And so we said past data is not a good indicator. Building back to what we knew results in structures being lost a second and third time. It's not a good investment of your tax dollars. And we cannot continue a sustainable model in the current fiscal environment that says there will be disasters and for the uninsured losses you as a taxpayer are going to pay. So we said, well, let's change things. First of all, who does a good job at looking at future risk? And we looked around in government, and there's not really a good skill set there. I mean, NOAA's probably gotten closest with the Weather Service and the climatologists looking at what potential impacts can be in trend data. But there's such a range that it's really not something that's actionable. So we started looking at, well, who does do a fairly good job of looking at future risk? And who would have a stake in it? And we started looking at the reinsurance world. And we said, you know, there's one good thing about looking at an insurance model. If you are building to the risk, people will invest their money in your risk. If you're not building to the risk, people will not make that investment. They won't provide you affordable insurance. And we ended up in the 60s getting into the flood insurance business because the insurance industry said as a whole, based upon how we have built and our exposure to flood, it's not an insurable risk. So the federal government got into it. And with all of its challenges, I'll tell you, if anybody wants you to be a direct payee as an insurance company, run. But here's the problem. If we look at how we have best managed risk, an effective tool that goes outside of government is willingness of investors to put their money on a bet that you have built in a way that the risk of insurance allows me to make a profit. This is not a charity. But think about it. Most of the disaster costs that we pay in these large-scale events beyond emergency response costs and picking up debris on the public assistance side, the money we pay to local governments, goes to uninsured structures. Why are they uninsured? Well, we hear a lot of reasons. Well, it's unaffordable. Really what it is transferring risk back to you, the taxpayer. But what if we started treating those structures as something that we're not going to continue to underwrite the risk the way we have? One proposal that we've broached is within the disaster assistance programs, if you get a presidential disaster declaration, if the president declares that disaster, we always go back to the first dollar. I don't know of any insurance program anymore that runs to the first dollar. You always have a deductible. If there's not skin in the game, behavior doesn't always change. So we said, well, what if we created in the federal disaster program under the Stafford Act deductibles? And said, we're not going to go back to the first dollar. We'll start at some dollar, but we're not going to go back to the first dollar. So if you don't have those structures insured, you're going to pay for it, at least some of it. But then we want to give incentives. This is the other thing we've learned from the insurance industry. If you want people to take basic steps to reduce risk, like have a working fire extinguisher, give them a discount. So what if we gave credits to states and jurisdictions that had appropriate building codes, had enforcement, used land use, and took steps to reduce risk so they could buy the deductible down? The other thing we looked at is our overly dependent process of looking at cost-benefit analysis. This is something, again, we looked, who are the leaders in standards and codes? It's with the insurance industry. And every standard and code is a compromise between what is absolute versus what is practical, and then what you can get people to agree to across a lot of interest. But we found too oftentimes, if we could look at newer codes and newer standards, it would make more sense to build to that. But we were locked into a process that said we built back to whatever the local code was, and in many cases there were no codes, and anything above that we would treat as mitigation. And again, we'd be back to cost-benefit analysis, and we'd be back to historical data, even though in many cases we knew the science, engineering, and codes were much better and more appropriate for the risk. And instead of just treating that as a cost of rebuilding, we were still treating it as mitigation and a very convoluted process. So we have changed that to where we look to international standards, like the International Code Council, that has more appropriate codes. And I'll give you one example, and then I'm going to bail because I got to go to a change of command ceremony. Safe rooms. Leslie and Flash have been pushing safe rooms forever, and the only way I could get schools to build them is if they had a disaster was to offer them a mitigation project, which they'd have to do the cost-benefit analysis to score it, to build it. And in some cases, it was so complex, jurisdictions didn't do it. And I'll give you an example. When you've been here for the length of time I have, even that's not really long. When you go back to the same school that's been destroyed twice, first time was in 2010. I won't go into the state, but a school got flattened, totally destroyed. It was a middle school. Fortunately, no loss of life. It was not insured. So you, the taxpayer, paid 75% to rebuild that school. About 2 years later, I went back to that same site. The school got flattened a second time. We had offered in the cost-benefit mitigation program to build safe rooms. The jurisdiction chose not to. The only reason there were no students in that school was it was weeks away from completion. The only reason you as taxpayers didn't pay for it the second time was it was still being carried under the construction company's insurance program. But we literally had a school that was destroyed twice within a couple of year period. Both times would have been uninsured, and both times would have not had safe rooms for the children inside of that school. And after Moore, Oklahoma, the president gave me the challenge of, why are we not doing this? And we had a very bureaucratic process and a very bureaucratic answer. So we made a decision. We had some new authority from the Sandy Recovery Improvement Act. And so we looked at our authorities and made a determination that rather than treating this as a mitigation project, and even though the local jurisdictions do not have a code requirement to build safe rooms, we were going to recognize that there was a standard and code, and we would adopt that, and we would offer to the school to rebuild that school with a safe room and not do any cost-benefit analysis. We would put it into the cost of rebuilding, just like you have to meet code for the American with Disabilities Act, the National Electrical Code, the Fire Safety Code. We were going to treat it as a code requirement, and it opened a window into our ability to take what in many cases is funded through the insurance industry of best practices and best standards of how to build for the environment we're in, including a changing environment. And instead of waiting for local jurisdictions and states to catch up or adopt codes or more red tape, as people like to refer to it, We would use the best engineering, best data through a consensus process to build back to and not subject local communities to the cost-benefit analysis. Our goal is not to rebuild schools after disasters and tornadoes in particular without adequate, defensible, protected space for the occupants of that school when F4, F5 tornadoes strike. And so in this administration, we're focusing on the outcome changes, but we're also looking outside of government for the answers and the solutions. Too oftentimes, I think we take a government-centric problem solution to everything we face, instead of going back out and going, how do we address this with what we call the whole community? Who out there actually looks at future risk from a standpoint of what investors will invest in versus what taxpayers may inherit without any say? What are the best practices of how to build in a changing environment? And how do we reduce the disruption of these events to where it won't be, there will be no disasters, well, there'll be no more loss of life, but that it will be within the existing coping mechanisms that do not require extraordinary fiscal or other cost to deal with the rebuilding efforts, and that as we build going forward, we don't limit ourselves to what happened in the past, but we build to future risk, and in many cases, use the willingness of investors to invest in that risk as a guidepost, did we do enough? Because my bottom line is, if the private sector isn't going to insure your risk, either you're not building it in the right place the right way. So it better be a good return on the public's investment for the public taxpayer to absorb that risk. So I'm never saying we don't do it, but the facility or infrastructure should provide greater benefit to the public than the insurable risk that we're taking when the private sector won't insure it. And it may be a simplistic model, but I have just come to the conclusion that if we only offer grants, both pre and after disasters, to do the right thing, it won't be sustainable. There needs to be a more persistent, everyday financial cost to the total ownership of infrastructure and homes for the public that is affordable and appropriate for the risk. But we're only going to get there if we build where and how based upon risk with the best data that the private sector says, yes, I'll put my money there because I can make a profit, a reasonable profit, and cover your risk. And if something happens, issue that check so you can rebuild and get back in your home, get back in your business, get that facility rebuilt versus waiting for, in some cases, a reluctant Congress to pass supplementals to pay for those losses. So I'm very much focused on outcomes. I'm not focused on what government's going to do per se, but how government can best fit the various processes and models to build for future risk, not just the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Administrator Fugate. Both Brian and Craig's remarks have perfectly set the stage for the discussions of this morning. We're going to move on to the next panel discussion, which is entitled Investing in Resilience. And this discussion will be a chance to both make the case and delve further into the value of pre-disaster mitigation and explore both the federal policy innovations that this administration is pursuing, but also the growing public and private sector interest in innovative financing mechanisms. I'd like to introduce the moderator of the next panel, Angela Gladwell, who's the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Risk Management at FEMA. Among her many other responsibilities, she's also leading the development of the National Mitigation Investment Strategy, which you'll hear more about. So I'd like to have all of the panelists come to the stage, and Angela will introduce the other panelists. Thank you.
Good morning. Very happy to have you here today talking about pre-disaster mitigation and how we collectively can incentivize and leverage public and private sector to develop innovative financing mechanisms. In the development of the National Mitigation Investment Strategy, we have determined that there are many challenges that are preventing us from investing in pre-disaster mitigation. We know that we have an overemphasis on post-disaster relief. We know that there is a lack of general awareness and the value of investing in mitigation, and that's harder prior to a disaster. And we know that there are many bureaucratic and coordination obstacles to breaking down the boundaries and working across organizations to do what we need to do to reduce losses. But one of the reasons for having this panel here today is that we can change that dynamic. And there are many places where this is effectively occurring. And what we need to do is understand what's working well and who we need to include and who we need to engage so that we can reduce losses, so that we can think about future risks, both in terms of our infrastructure, which we'll hear about today, broader incentives, and again, that private sector engagement. So we have a great panel here today that I would like to just briefly introduce. First, we have Jeff Herbert, who serves as a deputy mayor and chief resilience officer at the City of New Orleans. We have Jake Broderfinger, who is a senior policy advisor on the National Economic Council at the White House. We have Deborah Ballin, who is with IBHS, served as general counsel and senior vice president of public policy. And we have Leonardo Martinez-Diaz as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy and Environment at the U.S. Treasury. So what I would like to ask you first, and Jeff, I'm going to start with you, is where have you seen incentives work for communities from the local government perspective, and why did those efforts succeed?
Yeah, thanks, Angela. I think there's a couple of things that have changed in the country and in local governments really since, about 10 years since Hurricane Katrina and really after Hurricane Sandy, which is understanding how to leverage and maximize resources that really are starting to think about investing wisely. So as Administrator Fugate said a couple minutes ago on the analysis of building something two and three times in the same place and in the same way, I think a lot of us have realized that that's not practical and is in many ways completely idiotic, to be honest, because a lot of those costs are borne by the local government. If you look at what happens during a disaster, the longer downtime, the bigger impact you have on community, the bigger impact you have on the economy, and for local governments, the bigger impact you have on the budget because you're not taking in revenues. And so the ability to invest wisely and provide incentives at the local level or pass down incentives through federal, state, to the local, and then to those folks in the communities makes a lot of sense from a practical standpoint of how you run government and how you are able to have communities bounce back much faster than they have been in the past. On the sort of the planning side of that, thinking about incentivizing through programs, things that we've done after Katrina, particularly around building code reform, investing very smartly in mitigation, which we had not done previously in New Orleans, and focusing on infrastructure and green infrastructure to provide additional mitigation measures whole cloth for communities instead of looking at one-by-one strategies, which have not worked. And then finally, looking at what we can do in community. So a lot of the problems that we have in having people invest themselves is that they really don't understand the reality that they're facing. And by working, our mayor, Mayor Landrieu, has a line that we all sort of live off of, facilitate, link, and leverage. And that really is a philosophy about state, local, federal government, but also community, philanthropy, and local government working together to start to address the issues of education and outreach, which I think are a huge part of investing in mitigation, is that people really don't understand their risk and their reality, and it is on us at the local level to try to educate so that people understand. So incentives to provide for those measures. For us, through the National Disaster Resilience Competition, as mentioned earlier, we have a resilience retrofit program, which we'll target to low and moderate income homeowners. But the ability for that to happen rests with the ability for us to communicate. And so working with the communities has been a big change for us over the past decade.
Great, thank you, Jeff. So Jake, can you tell us about what you've seen work, especially as it relates to infrastructure and some of your experience in Build America?
Sure. So to maybe just put things in perspective, I think it's helpful to note the magnitude of the infrastructure deficit that we have in the U.S. right now. So currently we spend about half of 1% of GDP on infrastructure. That's about a third of what it was 60 years ago. And you know, if you look at other countries, they're spending 5, 8, 10% of GDP on infrastructure. There's a range of organizations out there who have sort of put a price tag on our infrastructure deficit. Some have put it in the trillions of dollars. Regardless of the number, it's clearly very large. So I think the question becomes not only how can we invest more smartly, as Jeff mentioned, but also how do we do it at scale, right? Because there's a really large scale investment that's needed here. And the impact is significant. I know some experts have said that over the next 20 years, climate, and in particular sort of a lack of resilient investment, could cost up to 2% of GDP. So there's a serious economic impact for our country if we don't figure out a way to invest in resiliency and invest in it at scale. There's a few things that we've seen that are starting to work at a federal level, and I can talk to those for just a minute. On the president's charge, launched the Build America Investment Initiative in July of 2014, which was set out to really focus on smarter investment in infrastructure and increase public-private collaboration on infrastructure investment for things like resiliency. Through the initiative, there's a few things that I'll highlight right now. One is the initiative has launched a series of finance centers at the Department of Transportation, EPA, USDA and DOI that are focused on resilient investment, among other things. Second, there's been a new push at the federal level around pre-development, which we think is a very important tool to really institutionalize good upfront planning and resiliency in the way that we invest in resilient investment in our infrastructure. And then third is, you know, supporting important initiatives like the Natural Disaster Resiliency Competition that Brian mentioned earlier. And these are just a few things that we've seen starting to have an impact on the way we invest. But clearly, this is a space where we need to do much more and figure out ways that we can really standardize our approaches so that, you know, the good things that are being done in New Orleans are picked up in other parts of the country, and we're doing it not just on a sort of one-off basis, but everywhere, and using all those dollars to promote good investment.
Great. Thank you, Jake. Deborah, tell us about this from your perspective. What have you seen working? And I'm real interested in what you've seen in terms of economic incentives as well.
Okay, well, thank you. And kudos for this administration for having this event today, and more importantly, for being engaged. I think the term all in was a very apt one. So thank you for having me here today. IBHS does a lot of work with respect to building science. We have this fabulous laboratory in South Carolina, and I was there the day that we invited our board of directors in, and we are very proud. We finished it on time, on budget. And they said, well, what are you doing, what are you going to do with this? You know, if a building blows down in South Carolina, but no one is aware of it, you've done some interesting scientific research, but you really have not changed the built environment. So a lot of our efforts are directed both at communications and at programs that really will make a difference. And I want to focus on one right now, which is the IBHS Fortified program. It is both a building standard for resilient, some would say code plus, although we just like to say stronger, building for both residential and commercial applications, but particularly the residential one has gotten more play. The important thing about it is that we believe in the science. The science has been tested about what those standards are. Second, it's a system. In order to make sure that your building is resilient, you got to sort of do everything. You can't have like one of your windows covered and say, oh, window covering, no problem. If the wind blows, you've got to do everything. So it's a system. We do have different designation levels, bronze, silver, and gold, but you got to do everything. And third of all, it's got to be inspected as the building is being constructed or retrofitted, because you can have a standard. We learned in Hurricane Andrew with building codes. You can have a strong building code, but if it isn't enforced, it's not necessarily in the building. So we do all those things, and then we wind up with the designation. And one of the things that we're beginning to find, we're trying to scale up this program, focusing on target markets, because people, the buzz is important. People talking about, you know, what they've done, why they're proud of what they're doing is very important. Coastal Alabama is our best market so far. And just today, I think, the University of Alabama, Lars Powell is in the audience here as the author, or one of the authors of this study, is literally releasing a study today showing that they found a 6.8% increase in real estate values for fortified homes versus non-fortified homes there. So in a nutshell, what we're trying to do is start with the science, then add in what do you need to wrap around the science to make sure that this is proven, and then third of all, how do you demonstrate value? And this is one example, I think, of a microcosm of fortified homes in coastal Alabama, but if we can do this in a lot of other areas, that's one way to get to resiliency.
Great. Thank you, Deborah. Leah, we'd like to hear from you. I know you've done a lot of work internationally, especially on the infrastructure front. I'm interested in how do we bring some of those learnings to the United States?
Thank you. When we look out at the international space, especially in developing countries, what we see, I think, is a replay of the same story that we've heard already. That is to say, countries are relying primarily on either foreign disaster assistance in the aftermath of a major disaster, or they are socializing the risk internally. Or, of course, things don't get paid. That's the third option, which is extremely damaging for development. So what we're trying to do is sort of three legs here. One is try to finance better data infrastructure in the countries. As the administrator mentioned, you need to have that data in place. And a lot of the data, frankly, is put out by the U.S. government already. A lot of countries rely on NOAA and NASA satellite data. But increasingly, it's important to have also ground-based observation infrastructure. And many countries don't have that. And so we're doing that through a number of multilateral funds. Now, what's important is not just to have the data, but to ensure that it's put in a in an interface that makes it usable and understandable to businesses, to households, to governments. And that's, I think, really crucial. The second thing is mainstreaming. That is to say, ensuring that climate considerations are baked into the design of foreign assistance programs, so that when we build a bridge in Malawi, when we finance a water plant in Fiji, that is being built for the standards of tomorrow, so that we have in place infrastructure that is going to be around for a long time. And the last is, I think, the importance of parametric insurance. In many places, what's crucial is that you get a fast injection of liquidity right in the aftermath of a disaster. I'm talking the first 2 weeks after a disaster, because that is the window in which a successful and an effective response is crucial for the long-term impacts that event will have. And so in many places, we are, with our partners, the World Bank and other places, trying to capitalize facilities that pull together the risk of several countries and then allow them to essentially transfer some of that risk to reinsurance markets so that they can have really fast liquidity using parametric designs, which is a lot quicker than the traditional indemnity-based insurance that we often use. So what are the lessons, I think, for us here in the domestic setting? I think there's a sort of four come to mind. The first is we have to get the prices right. That is to say, the price has to reflect the risk. And by the price, I mean most obviously the insurance premium. But also, you know, over time, mortgages, credit ratings, and so on, they have to reflect the risk. That's the only way in which you really get behavior change, in which you really get to incentivize and reward resilience behavior. The second is we need to think more about expanding parametric insurance in the U.S. as well. I think there's many opportunities to do that. And again, the critical issue here is how do you get the liquidity to flow really quickly rather than waiting for the assessors to look at all the actual damage on the ground. The third is about the importance of contingency planning. When we put in place these disaster risk insurance facilities, one of the crucial conditions is that in exchange for receiving and participating in these facilities, you must have in place very strong contingency planning so that when the event actually hits and you get a payout from the insurance, you know exactly how you're going to deploy that financing. You may not, obviously you'll need flexibility because every disaster is going to be different, but you need to have in place the protocols, the interagency practices. You need to have had a conversation with all of your ministries and your local governments to figure out how you're going to deploy that liquidity. And finally, we have to put in place a much more robust system for data infrastructure that people can actually use. I think the federal government will continue to put out all the data that we have until now. But the next question is, and the crucial one, is how do you bring that down to people, to businesses, to households, in systems that allow them to understand how that is relevant for them? And that customization is, I think, where a lot of the value is going to be added. How do you bring that raw data down to interfaces, software, programs that then allow people to make decisions, business decisions, on a day-to-day basis? And that's, I think, where the private sector will play a really crucial role.
Thank you. I'm interested, from any of you that want to respond, who are the unusual suspects in this process? Who do we need to be reaching out to, including, that we normally wouldn't in order to achieve pre-disaster mitigation?
Well, I'll say from our side, when we look at scenarios of, what happens, and as the administrator said earlier, the metrics that we've looked at and that we design our nomenclature on these systems just doesn't work. I mean, we've had two-thirds of our average annual rainfall in New Orleans we actually had up to April. So we haven't even, once you go beyond April, we're going to far surpass our average annual rainfall this year, which to us shows that clearly things have changed, are changing, and will continue to change, and we need to continue to plan for that. When we look at that in New Orleans on a flooding, just looking at the flooding piece of that, we have to understand how our systems can manage that additional rainfall, and also understand, based on the projections that we see from NOAA, how much more we're going to have to handle, and the possibilities of there being some sort of system failure at some point, or some sort of thinking about how the system will not be able to respond in the event of a disaster, given the way water and power sort of intersect. So two things for us, looking at, of course, mitigation in general and how we can do more in the natural environment to manage water. But the second thing is looking at ways to work with our service providers in those systems and prepare them for the resilience of the systems that will need to be put in place ahead of time. So investing in the resilience of those systems up front, while on the backhand also understanding that something could happen, and preparing those system providers for, sort of similar to what Leo was discussing before, some sort of infusion that can happen once something triggers, so that they can come back much more quickly. For us, that's looking at our stormwater system, because that is our biggest risk, is not having service, electrical service to the water system, or a backup service to the water system go down, and having the city flood. We can keep up. We've done pretty well for the past 110 years, with the exception of Katrina. But the issue of being able to provide the triple redundancy and the ability for investments to come in right after a disaster, working with that service provider, and this is something we've working on actually with Swiss Re and Veolia. Veolia is our service provider through work with the Rockefeller Foundation that someone will talk about a little bit later. But really thinking of different ways of financing and different ways of investing in support for building resilience, while also understanding that something could happen and we need some immediate infusions to be able for the city to manage itself in a much shorter period of time than you saw in Katrina. But I think thinking about those other partners inside of government who are your service providers, and having them start to think through the resilience of what they provide to the city, I think is something that we've started to focus on.
Excellent. Anyone else want to answer that?
Yeah, I'd like to add a few more. I'll add three. First of all, mortgage lenders, and I know some of them are here. We need to hear more from the mortgage lending community. Someone told me only four people had signed up for the breakout on mortgage lenders, so I hope you four have a lot of really good ideas to bring. Second of all, the business community generally. Our industry is insurance, and I go to a lot of meetings and they say, oh, the business is here because look, the insurance industry is a business, but insurance is a risk transfer mechanism. It's not the businesses that are there in communities, and I think at the national level, when you have large institutions, we need to make resilience one of their core values. Core values are very big right now in business, and we need to really inculcate this. And at the local level, businesses need to understand it's their bottom line and their employees that are affected, and whether it's having business continuity plans, having emergency preparation, or having just strong and resilient buildings, that is what keeps communities together. If all of the homes are strong but the buildings are not, everyone's going to leave because they have no more jobs. And third of all, one of our partners in this has been Habitat. And Habitat, I'm just using really as an example of a nonprofit that is there building, affordable, for housing for people who cannot otherwise afford to own homes. And that leads us to the vulnerable populations that we need to make sure that that they are given or have the resources so that they can be part of resilience as well.
Leah.
I mean, for us, it's been finance ministers. And the reason is that they appreciate the long-term implications of a disaster that has not been planned for. And they understand the cost of having to redirect funding away from infrastructure, from education, from health, to pay for some of these events. So bringing it back to the domestic context, I think it's crucial to talk to the financial planners at the state and local levels, because they appreciate the larger picture. And they then become key champions inside the government, pressing for more forward-looking types of solutions.
Okay. So I know that we don't have a whole lot of time left on our panel, but I'd like for you to think about the next decade. What do you hope to see 10 years from now in the space of a pre-disaster mitigation? Where do you think that we could be as a nation?
So I think there's a few things that would help us get to a place of success in the next decade. First, I think is really developing a strong set of use cases between the public and private sector, where we're co-investing in projects. We're seeing good returns for the private sector. We're seeing reasonable returns for the private sector, where the public sector doesn't feel like they've been taken advantage of. And we can then point to those use cases to help build out a broader pipeline of projects. I think second is, within that context, figuring out what are the approaches that are working and that can be standardized so that, as we look to expand this space, we can have a few cookie cutter approaches where you say, hey, this is the way we do it. And it works, and we've shown it works, and then you can see the private capital sort of come off the sidelines to invest in this space. And then I think third, and I know others have mentioned this as well, is making resiliency a greater part of our general taxonomy as we think about investing in infrastructure, so that it's sort of top of mind, it's part of the conversation, it's there right in front of you. Anytime someone starts thinking about, investing in a road, a bridge, a port, a highway, a water system, that's front and center in the debate.
Okay. Thank you. Others? Where could we be?
Well, I think what we need is nothing less than a shift in paradigm in the way in which people think about planning and risk. And I think that means, first of all, accepting that we now live in a more dangerous world from the point of view of climate and extreme events, but then not sort of scaring the hell out of people only, We also need to provide solutions. We need to provide instruments and tools that people can use and to show them and empower them to deploy them in an effective way. And I think we're building, we have a lot of the ingredients on the ground here, but I think in 10 years, we should be able to see that become mainstream, become fully integrated into the way we do business in housing, in infrastructure, in government planning. And that, I think, will be crucial for success in meeting this challenge.
Okay. Deborah.
Just really quickly off of those two, I think with the investments that the Obama administration has made in resilience and making it a top-of-mind issue, I think from a local perspective, I think it's on us to have really worked on the models, and then we've begun to institutionalize them to where it's not even a conversation about naming it pre-disaster mitigation or resilience, that it is the norm for how cities and states do business. And I hope that with all of the effort that the federal government, state governments, and local governments, but really led by the Obama administration and really the nonprofit sector, particularly foundation support like the Rockefeller Foundation and Kresge and others, is to really, really institutionalize that on the ground so that we're really not even having this conversation, because it is the way we do business. And if we don't, frankly, accomplish that over the next decade, I think we're going to be in for some really, really terrible times, both here in the U.S. and abroad.
Absolutely agree with that. And as interesting as this is, if we're not having this in 10 years because it's automatic, that would be a definition of success. I know that you're responsible for the National Mitigation Investment Strategy, and I think what you're trying to do is be cohesive and coherent about taking all of the work that's been done and really moving it forward. The immediate focus would be a next administration, but really much beyond that. So that it is as built into our environment as the buildings themselves. The private sector level, I think a great example is the auto safety movement. I am old enough to remember the fights over airbags. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and all of a sudden you started having crashes of airbag against airbag, and the cars were completely destroyed, but the people survived. And it became an automatic thing. And even when we've had problems with airbags recently, with Takata airbags, no one says, take the airbag out of my car. They say, I want a safe airbag. And that's how we have to have the built environment. I want a safe house. It's just intrinsic in what I do. And then I think we'll get to where we all want to be. So thank you.
That's fabulous. Thank you. And that's a good transition as we close, because what we want to do with this is really start a national conversation as we are trying to understand in the development of the National Mitigation Investment Strategy how we can really leverage our collective resources and programs together to reduce losses. We need to continue these conversations. And I think aspiring to where we can be and to the outcomes that you've identified in 10 years is a great place for us to move towards. So I want to thank you all for the panel. Thank you for your time and your remarks. Thank you.
Thank you.